I get 2 points for remembering, and another point if it runs through till the end of the lecture. If you tried, did anybody try on the website to see if you could get the recordings? Yeah, okay. You might check that out just to see if it works. We didn't get all of Wednesday's lecture. For some reason, it stopped. And I have no idea why that was. Welcome. Let's see. Housekeeping details. Does anybody need the syllabus? It's here. Okay. Julie has a handout. Are you up to it?
I am.
She's feeling better today. Okay. Just spread it around. I intended for that to be stapled to the syllabus, but it didn't get there, so there it is. This is a page that I hope you will refer to as you are writing for this class, for all of the written assignments. What I've tried to do is to capture the things that annoy me when I'm reading, the things that make my brain hiccup or make me stumble as I'm reading along. And these are the list of pet peeves and some suggestions for things that you might try to avoid doing in your writing in this course and in all of your courses, since if you do them, they're mistakes. So you might as well work on not making mistakes in your writing. So if you have questions about any of these, feel free to email me and I'll give you a grammar lesson or spelling. Spelling, you should just accept my way of doing it. Usage and grammar, I'll be happy to explain. But I won't take class time for that, since I'm a frustrated English teacher. Okay. I'm going to pass the roster around again. Jazz started it over there last time. None of you are sitting in the same place. But if you would just check off in the right-hand column, which is labeled 23 January, just check off if you're here. It gives me a sense of who's missing, so I can start chasing people down if necessary. I created some confusion by assigning reading for today, which you don't have and don't have access to. It is the Shelton reading, which when I checked with the printer at 10:30 this morning, they had not started to bind yet, and therefore said they could not deliver by 1 o'clock. But it will be done this afternoon. So I will have it, and I will email you to remind you. It will be available for purchase in our office in Living Learning. I don't know the price yet because I haven't gotten the final figure from the printer. But we will have it there. You can pick it up if you want to catch up and start to get ahead. If you can't make it over to Living Learning between now and Wednesday's class, I will bring copies here and you can buy it here. It won't be in the bookstore and it's not on reserve. I can't sell it to the bookstore because they would charge you $3 or $4 more than I do, and you don't want to do that, right? They take their cut. We don't take a cut. And Julie deserves it, but she doesn't get anything. And I can't put it on reserve in the library because of copyright issues at this point. So hopefully this will be the last year we have to do it this way. Okay. Is that all I have? Okay. Questions? So how many of you did the reading for today? Okay. Sorry, you didn't need it. You'll catch up quickly. Questions about anything I said on Wednesday? Okay. Everything makes sense. Or nothing. So, I want to elaborate today to talk about some more assumptions in looking at how we approach this course, and then I want to get into the meat of the course. But I like to talk about definitions and assumptions. One is that if we do that, you can see better. And if we do that, you can see even better than that. Okay, and these are on the web, so you don't have to frantically copy them down. I did update the first couple of days of the website. The syllabus is on it, and the overheads are up to date. So, some definitions and assumptions. This is the mini course in understanding human development. So as we talk about human development, we're going to make some assumptions about human beings, and these should be familiar. But one is that all human beings share some characteristics of our species. And then within that universal set of characteristics, there is a wide set of variants. There are a lot of differences among us, and much of that individual variation at the beginning is based in biological and genetic variation among us. We are a highly diverse species. We all share certain characteristics. We all have brains, eyes, ears, sensory systems with some variation, and we are all creatures that are adapting constantly to the experience that we have. We change biologically across time. Okay? So from conception to recycling, we are constantly in the process of changing. Some of the changes are dramatic: puberty, menopause, senescence at the end of life. Those are fairly dramatic changes, but we are all expected to go through them. Part of being human is to adapt to or accommodate the changes that take place biologically. So part of what we're doing as human beings is getting comfortable with our bodies, figuring out what we can do with them, making them work as well as possible, figuring out new skills, learning to play soccer, learning to walk, learning to deal with the changing proportions and potentials of the body at puberty, learning to deal with the infirmities of late middle age. But people are constantly adapting to their bodies and adapting their bodies. We are also constantly adapting to other people's transactions with us. But other people respond to us on the basis of the bodies that we have. So we look at infants and we say, "Aw, isn't she cute? You know, look at those cheeks, look at those cute little fingers." We get all goofy about infants. We respond differently depending on whether the baby is a boy or a girl. We interact with each other as adults differently depending on our appearance, our presumed sex, whether we are younger or older than the person that we're transacting with. The biological differences among us shape the interactions that we have with each other and the relationships that we develop with each other. Part of what happens within a family is that the family is constantly adapting to biological changes in children. part of what families do is respond to boys and girls differentially to help them become male and female and appropriate, maybe, in the culture that they're going to live in. Okay. So the biological changes help to shape what parents are doing. Biological differences among us, male, female, for example, shape the way people respond to us and what parents do to us. Even if they think they're not, most of us do differentiate on the basis of the characteristics. We tend to treat children who look like us differently than children who look different from us. Okay. We are, as the notion of adaptation implies, learning organisms. This distinguishes us from some organisms that don't do much learning. Some organisms don't change their behavior very much across their lifespan. Some organisms don't learn from experience. We do. We change our relationship to our environment as we have experience with it. We have brains that are designed to gather experience, to think about the experience, to learn from the experience. And we are organisms that seek out experience. We do crazy things like go to college, pay to have experience from which we expect to learn. We take courses that we expect to learn from. We learn from all of our important relationships. We learn from the people around us. We learn from the transactions in those relationships. We are gradually constructing knowledge about how the world works. We're gradually constructing an understanding of ourselves in the world. And we're gradually constructing skills to deal with the world. Again, these are on the web, so you don't have to be worried when I take them away before you've copied them all down. We are also social animals. It's another important assumption. Other people are important to us. They're important to us from before birth, but certainly at birth and for the rest of our lives. We are reared by other human beings, typically in families. We try to maintain and create relationships with other people. We develop attachments and emotional reactions to other people. We try to seek those people out. We also develop attachments to other species. If you were here when Professor Sterrett left with his pet plant, I was kidding him about the fact that he brings a pet plant to class. I'm expecting to see it appear every class period. I know for a fact that he is, in fact, emotionally attached to some of his plants. I am, too. How many of you have plants that you're attached to? Some of you have dogs or cats that you're attached to. You hate to see them go. Some of us bend our lives a little bit out of shape to maintain our attachments to those plants. How many of you have ever had an argument or a fight with a roommate or a family member because he or she killed a plant? Yeah, some of us do that. You're my kind of people. I have a plant that was given to me when my daughter was born by my mentor. Okay, so here we have a gift from a very important person in my life the man that I studied under to get my doctorate and worked with for several years. And the gift was in recognition of the birth of my first child, 37 years ago. I still have the plant. He was very, very clever in his choice of plants. He gave one that's hard to kill, is very hardy, and that has a very long lifespan. So having kept the thing around and transported it from Minneapolis to Pittsburgh to Richmond to Underhill to South Burlington to South Burlington and kept it alive through a number of moves, you develop attachments. It becomes important. We are sappy, soppy, sentimental organisms. This is good. Yes. The observation is that if you put work into something, you develop an attachment to it. And this is a very well-documented phenomenon in social psychology. And its version there is that the harder it is to get into something, into a group, the more you value the group. Thus, fraternities and sororities, the Marine Corps, organizations of that sort make it very difficult to get in. They make you work really hard. That's why we have hazing. Well, why we used to have hazing. Now we don't have hazing. Well, the Marine Corps, you still have hazing. But one of the reasons to make things difficult to get into is that people value them more and develop more loyalty. They develop attachment to the organization. The same thing appears to apply to people and other things that we put effort into. It might explain, for example, why people hang on to abusive relationships far beyond the point when they should have bailed. It's always a difficult thing to understand. Why does somebody stay in an abusive relationship? It's very frustrating if you work with abused women that they keep going back, or they'll call the hotline and talk about how terrible their relationship is, but they won't walk out of it. And if they walk out, they often go back. The rule of thumb is that the typical abused spouse leaves 6 or 7 times before she actually ends the relationship and stops going back. How do you explain that? One of the ways you explain it is that people have put a great deal of effort into the relationship. They have tried to shape their lives in a way that will make the relationship work. They take responsibility for the relationship. The harder you've worked to make a relationship improve, the harder it is to give it up.
A comfort level has something to do with that? Like, the more work you put into a relationship, the easier it is to make that stay in, because you know what to expect in certain situations. Maybe like a plant, you know, you kept your plant alive for 36 years. If you have a brand new plant, if you have a whole other relationship, you have to learn how to retain.
The observation is that part of the loyalty to something, I'm going to paraphrase it, part of the loyalty is because you create a familiarity. You know what to expect, and the familiarity in the relationship makes it difficult to leave, especially if you're leaving for the unfamiliar. Creating a new relationship may be more difficult than hanging on to the old one. That's true. And it's difficult for people to take off into the unknown. When you look at relationships, for example, again, sticking with the abusive relationships, the abuser that you know and understand maybe, certainly is more familiar and maybe less anxiety producing than the relationship that you don't know is really out there. One of the reasons that people who are in relationships that they're not happy with, one of the reasons that people have affairs is so they can demonstrate to themselves that there is another relationship out there, rather than leaving the relationship they're unhappy with and being confident that there is another relationship. Some people can't risk being without a relationship. You can't risk not having a partner. So they create a new partnership and then go from one to the other. We'll talk about that as we look at dating and relationships and changes in relationships, because it's a very common feature, and it's also developmentally a very problematic feature, that people would rather have a bad relationship than no relationship. And people who stay in bad relationships tend to go into more bad relationships. And it appears that the most important developmental experience happens during the time between relationships. The people who do, in fact, as adults, spend time not in a partnership develop more confidence and more skills and are less likely to go into another bad relationship. So time alone, time unpartnered, exploring the unfamiliar for many of us, the unfamiliar, non-partnered world may be important in developing the skills which were on the previous overhead. Developing the skills of having good relationships. You may be able to do that better when you're not going from bad relationship to bad relationship. One of the reasons people stay in relationships is because they can't be on their own. And a second, as you suggest, is that we try to recreate the familiar. So we tend to go into the same kind of relationship that we just got out of, rather than figuring out how to have better relationships and going into one that might be more satisfying. We'll talk about that in more detail, but it's one of the situations where developing attachments and learning the skills of having relationships may be fraught with problems for us as human beings. Life might be easier without attachments. On the other hand, it might be far less satisfying. Okay, I've referred several times to experience and particularly transactions with other people. Transactions with other people, relationships that we develop with other people, are a very important part of development for human beings. In our relationships, both parties tend to change. That's what makes the experience a transaction. A transaction is an experience in which both people are changed. We don't all have the same experience. The human experience is quite diverse, and it is the experience that we have with other people, on top of the diversity that we have biologically, that leads to the incredible diversity among us as human beings, particularly as adults. If you take our differences in biology, our different temperaments, our different multiple intellects, ways that we process information, and put those into the unique relationships that we develop with a variety of people, the experiences that we have tend to be quite different from anybody else's experience and help shape us into individuals. Now, that could be a very discouraging feature of being human. If we take all this diversity, biology, different brains, we take that diversity and then we all have different experiences, That creates more diversity, makes us much more interesting as a species. But it could be discouraging if you're trying to generalize about human development and about relationships. So it's one of the temptations that I run into occasionally is if somebody says, well, people are so different that there's no point even studying and generalizing about them because we're all different. It's true that we're all different, but it's still fun to study and generalize about the processes of development and how the differences come about. And that's my role in life. To study the processes that we all go through, going back to the fact that we are all human beings and we have some characteristics in common. And that makes some things predictable, and it makes it possible for us to generalize about the broad diversity that we experience. Generalizing is dangerous at times. It can lead to stereotypes. It can lead to overgeneralization. It can lead to assumptions about how people are or what they think or how they feel that keep you from finding out how the real person individually feels and is and thinks. So it's important to recognize the dangers in generalization. But we're going to go ahead through the rest of the course and generalize anyway. And we will occasionally bump our noses against the dangers of generalization. One of the reasons that we are going to use Bronfenbrenner's scheme, as you will read in the book that you don't have yet, one of the reasons that we're going to use his scheme is that his scheme is a very, very broad and general scheme that applies to all human beings. That was his goal, to create a scientific view of development within the human social context that would permit him to talk about anybody anywhere, regardless of culture, regardless of sex, regardless of intelligence. He wanted a scheme that was so broad that it would allow him to think about development of any person in any context. And he successfully created that. So that's why we use it. It allows us to deal with the individual differences, but to deal with them in a way that helps us understand how we're all following the same kinds of processes. It allows us to incorporate our individuality and our variations in experience and to account for, to understand the differences among us by looking at the differences in environments and taking into account the individual differences among us that encourage us or lead us to transact with our environments in unique ways. Okay, I've mentioned Bronfenbrenner. Let's jump right into him. Now, change the lamp, zoom out, there we go. And these again are not on the web but are in the book, so you'll have your very own copy. And I probably need more light, not less light. And the lamp didn't change. Technology, wonderful. You're watching me adapt to the room. Okay. Let's look first at human development. Now, I'm showing you this one to illustrate something. This is Bronfenbrenner's definition of human development. The process through which the growing person acquires a more extended, differentiated, and valid conception of the ecological environment and becomes motivated and able to engage in activities that reveal the properties of, sustain, or restructure that environment at levels of similar or greater complexity in form and content. Okay, got that? There'll be a test on that at the end. The ecology of human development, which is the title of Bronfenbrenner's primary work, the ecology of human development involves the scientific study of the progressive mutual accommodation between an active growing human being and the changing properties of the immediate settings in which the developing person lives. As this process is affected by relations between the settings and by the larger context in which the settings are embedded. Okay, now, I showed you this one in black and white because I wanted to point out that these are both very complex statements. So one of the things that I do to help me deal with the complexity, and I encourage you to do this, is I use color. And what I do is use different colors for different phrases. So I'm essentially parsing. Remember parsing? Did you do that in grammar? No. Parsing, not a word. No. You don't parse anymore. Okay. Well, add this to your vocabulary. When I was a kid, parse, it's a verb. It means to break down into its components. What you probably did, I hope, in grammar was diagram sentences. Right? Did you do that? You got diagram sentences. You hated that, didn't you? How many of you diagrammed sentences? How many of you really loved studying grammar by diagramming sentences? It is, although you hated it, it is probably one of the most important critical thinking tools that you were ever exposed to, and you probably didn't get enough of it. So, you can make up for that by continuing to do it the rest of your life, which means take sentences apart and figure out what they really mean, and it also helps you write clearly. Okay. So what I do is take apart Bronfenbrenner's words, because he tends to write very complexly. I take them apart by picking out the various phrases, clauses, subphrases, and highlighting them in different colors. I will do that through the rest of this unit. I will do all of that. The book, unfortunately, that you have is a really cheapy edition, and it is in black and white. So, you know what? I'll bet when it really gets published, they're not going to publish it in color either, because that is so expensive. But I'll make you an offer. If you would like to have the version that I'm going to use through this month in color, email me and ask for it, and I will send it to you as a Word document in color. And so you can have it on your own computer. The other approach is to go through the book and underline in different colors or whatever you'd like. But if you want this version, just email me and I'll send it. All right, so this might help. Human development, that's what we're defining. It's a process. Okay. It's a process. Human development is not the product, it's the process. It's what you go through, and in this case, from conception to recycling. And it's a process through which a growing person, and we're all growing all the time, But notice, this is where he puts in the notion that we are constantly changing. Biological change is fundamental. The process through which the growing person acquires, gets somehow, a more extended, that means bigger, differentiated, that means more complex. It means that it's more, give me a synonym for differentiated, broken down into smaller and smaller parts so that you can understand it, and more valid conception. View. Conception, that doesn't mean making babies. It means understanding. So, in Bronfenbrenner's view, human development is the process through which I'm going through to make my view of the world that I understand, the world that I live in, the world that I experience, including my relationships, to make that view bigger, broader, taller, deeper, more differentiated. That means I understand its fine details in more complex ways. So my world gets more complex as I develop. My understanding of the world gets more complex. I understand the differences among things better. And my view gets more valid. And so I stop having delusions, or cut down on the number of delusions that I have. And valid view of the world means that I see it increasingly across life as it is. Not as I wish it were, not as it pretends to be, but as it really is. And when my view becomes more valid, then my transactions with the world potentially become more effective, more efficient, less problematic, because I see the world the way it really is and understand how it works. And that's the first half of the definition. And it's a very important definition, because it's different from almost all other definitions of development. Bronfenbrenner takes a stand. He says, I'm not interested in how tall you are. I'm not interested in looking at subtly defined stages. What he's interested in is your view of the world. Do you understand the world that you live in? That's what development is about. Is that view broad, deep, complex, and valid? Babies come into the world with very little knowledge of the world. And then, in his view, what we're trying to understand is the fact that their view gets better. Okay. He's not interested in IQ points. He's not interested in your test scores. He's not interested in how much money you make, whether you're independent or autonomous, how much trust you have, any of those other things that are covered in other people's definitions of development. What he's interested in is how valid is your understanding of the world that you live in. And more, human development is the process through which the growing person becomes motivated and able to engage in activities. It's not just what you understand, it's what you do with that understanding. Engage in activities that do what? reveal the properties of the world that you live in? Can you take it apart? Can you explore it? Can you investigate? That's how you reveal the properties of the world that you live in. Can you sustain that environment? Sustain it. Can you keep it? Can you keep your plant alive? Can you keep your plumbing working? Can you keep a job? Can you succeed in school? Can you keep your family functioning in a healthy fashion? Can you keep your body working? Activities that sustain, maintain the world and yourself. Or activities that restructure that environment. Can you alter the world? Can you make changes? Can you make changes that will make the world better? Can you arrange your room so that you can actually effectively study? Can you buy your groceries and organize recipes and cook so that you eat healthy and stay healthy? Can you improve a relationship? Do you have the skills to do that? To change a relationship that isn't working, not by getting out of it, but by changing the relationship. That's restructuring your environment. So you don't keep having the same argument over and over again without resolving it. So you don't have the same problem with your partner year after year after year. Stuck. So many couples do that. Do you have the skills to look at the problems? Do you have the conception of the world to look at the problems and understand them in a way that you can then use to change the problems, to improve the relationship? Can you make life more fun? Restructure your environment at levels of similar or greater complexity in form and content. Can you make it work better? Can you make it more fun? Can you be a more interesting person? Okay. So, Bronfenbrenner is latching on to some aspects of human behavior that other developmental theorists tend not to spend a lot of time on. And it flows from his belief that we really need to get where the rubber hits the road. People screw up the world. People screw up their lives. People screw it up by not understanding what's going on. People screw up the world by not understanding how it works and by not having the skills to use their understanding in ways that preserve the world or make it better. If we're really going to talk about an intelligent species, then let's look at how people develop their understanding. Let's look at how they develop their motivation to live in the world and their skills for doing that. And we don't need to spend a lot of time making up tests. We don't need to assign scores to people. That might be a fun activity, but it doesn't interest him. What he's interested in is whether or not kids grow up in ways that allow them to succeed in whatever way they think they want to succeed. Do schools produce people who really understand the world? Do parents encourage their kids to understand the world and help them develop the skills that will enable them to survive in the world and maintain the world without screwing it up anymore? Now, there's lots that isn't in here. There are lots of specific values that he doesn't specify. He's not going to define what success is. He's not going to define whether money is important or IQ points. There's lots that isn't in here. But what he has provided is very complex. We're going to look at the view of the world that a person is developing and the person's ability to deal with that world. And that's what we're going to think about as human development. And we're going to assume it gets more and more complex, that the view gets more and more valid, and that the person becomes more and more skilled. We're going to assume that it's progressive in that way. By the time you finish the course, you will be able to rattle off a paraphrase, not the exact words, but you'll keep in mind those two points. The view of the world that you have ought to be becoming more valid and complex, and your motivation and skill for dealing with the world ought to be becoming better. Okay, those two pieces. Now, the ecology. Of human development. Okay, scientific study. Oh, come on, I want to do my arts and crafts. I want to do my philosophy. No, he wants scientific study. Bronfenbrenner was a sociologist, taught in the Cornell Department of Human Development and Family Relations most of his career. And created essentially the field of ecology of human development. And this is his definition. And he wanted it to be scientific. So, when you encounter it in the book, you'll see that he's written propositions. And propositions in science are the things that you assume to be true. A proposition is something that you assume to be true. You propose it as true. Definitions, like this one. Definitions define, they isolate, and specify what it is that the science is about. Hypotheses are what you suggest based on your propositions and your definitions. Hypotheses are what you suggest about how the world works. So what Bronfenbrenner did was take 30 or 40 years of study of human development and sociology and said, okay, if we break this down to its essential components, what is really, really helpful to know? How do we put those together in a way that allows us to think about development in context universally? That's what we have to have for a science of the ecology of human development. So we're going to make this scientific, and we're going to be as precise as possible. We're going to develop hypotheses, which we can then test. So what you'll encounter is, in the book, is about 50 hypotheses about how the world works. Some of them have pretty good tests behind them, experiments, research studies. Some of them don't. We're going to assume, for the sake of discussion, that they're all useful. They may or may not be true, but they're useful. And part of the challenge in the course is for you to think about whether or not they apply to your own experience. If they don't, why not? Are the hypotheses useful? Are they not? Are they true? Are they not? If you apply them, if you think of them as true, what would that lead you to do? I'm not going to assert that they're all true. I take them as hypotheses. They may or may not be true. They might be useful. I think they're fairly useful, which is why I keep teaching them. But I encourage you to question them. I encourage you to challenge them. Are they true? Are they not true? And as you apply them to your own experience, or attempt to apply them to your own experience, think about ways in which they might not be true. Bring those here. Bring those ideas here about ways in which they might not be true. Because Bronfenbrenner, in proposing a science of human development, the ecology of human development, was very clear that he was trying to stimulate people to think and to do research that would in fact test his hypotheses. He had no illusion that they're all true. He was trying to put them out in ways that he believed, but in ways that they were testable. So if they're not true, we can learn that. We can learn how they might be true in some cases, but not in others. Okay, so we're going to be dealing with a scientific study of what? The progressive mutual... Progressive means ongoing, and ideally getting more and more complex. That's debatable. Mutual. Mutual, that means both parts are engaged in it, which really is referring to a transaction. Progressive mutual accommodation. What is that? Accommodation is the process of making room for or changing your understanding to take into account your experience. That's it. Piaget, some of you may... Oh, there's an echo of Piaget there. Piaget talks about the process of accommodation as what you do in your thinking when you run into experience that is new, that doesn't fit your old thinking. You accommodate the new experience by changing your thinking. Whenever we're engaged in a transaction, we assume that both parties are changed by the experience. So Brontë-Brenner is assuming here that there is some kind of transaction going on, which is in the latter part of the sentence, and that as a result of that, both sides of the transaction are engaging in changing to accommodate the other. This is not easy stuff. Accommodation between an active growing human being, on one hand, and the changing properties of immediate settings. There's where we get to the ecology. The environment, the immediate settings that you are in. The ecology of human development is the study of the relationship, the transaction, that I have with my immediate environment. As an example, me, now, you. You're my environment in this room, in the context of this course. And we are having a transaction. And I am accommodating your questions when they come up. I'm engaging in an activity to reveal the properties of my environment. In case you've noticed, I'm intently watching to see if you're just asleep, whether you're paying attention, or whether you just totally don't understand a word that I'm saying. And I'm getting pretty good feedback that you're awake, except for, well, I'm not going to specify, and that you're working very hard to try to follow my presentation. I can almost feel the work that you're doing, and I'm happy about that. So I keep going. If you were just all totally spaced out, I would accommodate that by changing my approach in some way. So we are engaged in a progressive mutual process of accommodating. You're trying to make sense out of what I'm saying. I'm trying to say it in ways that make sense, and I'm watching for the feedback. And we're engaged in a complex transaction. We are accommodating each other. It's mutual. We are mutually engaged. And as my immediate setting for this course, you're going to be changing constantly. I will be too, but hopefully it'll be even more noticeable for you as your understanding of the ecology of human development grows, as you develop a broader view of it, more differentiated view, and more valid view of it, and that's what I'm going to be trying to push you to do through this first unit. You are part of the immediate setting in which I live, if we think of me as the developing person. And the process that we're going to go through together, the process that any human being goes through in trying to mutually accommodate his or her environment, and the environment accommodate him or her, boy, that gets complex, doesn't it? That process is affected by everybody else around us. It's affected by your roommates. It's affected by the other courses that you're taking. It's affected by your jobs, your families, the weather, the reliability of your vehicle, your fascination with each other as you start scoping each other out and trying to pick each other up and make dates and develop relationships and get in the way of your... It'll affect the transaction that we have. Right? And my environment, the other relationships that I have, the other activities that I engage in, will affect the way I come in here and the way I behave in here. If the dean starts threatening me, then I'm going to become a little squirrely. I don't expect her to, but it's an example. If my wife doesn't come back from New Zealand in a couple of weeks, then I'm going to get really squirrely and I may disappear as I go try to find her. But I'm pretty sure she'll come back. She's having fun in New Zealand. Just don't tell her about the weather here. It's 75 degrees and sunny in New Zealand. Well, not right now. It's probably the middle of the night there, but, you know. My environment, my context, my other relationships, the other settings I live in affect what we do here. Yours affect what we do. Mine affect what we do. Whether the power is on, whether the media people keep a working bulb in the projector affect what we do. But Bronfenbrenner is suggesting that what we're going to be looking at as we look at the ecology of human development is a systematic way to understand how I and my environment transact with each other and how those are both affected by the other settings that are related to them, the other things going on in the environment. Now, the challenge in studying this stuff is keeping in mind that it's always changing. It's always a mutual accommodation between the individual and the environment. And the rest of your environment affects what goes on. And that's why he's doing it the way he's doing it. Because in real life, which is what we're trying to understand, the rest of your life affects what goes on in any part of your life. They're all connected. Everything is related to everything else. And he's trying to help us conceptualize those connections and those influences. Okay, some things that we hope, just checking, some things that we need to keep in mind from Bronfenbrenner. One is that he's very subtly looking at the world from the viewpoint of the developing person. And this becomes very important in understanding his approach. Human development is the process through which the growing person develops a valid view So it's the person's view that is important. Not what I think of the person. Not what you think of the person. What the person thinks about his or her world. Not what the person thinks about my world. What the person thinks about his or her world. Bronfenbrenner, unlike just about every other developmental theorist, is focused on the individual person and his or her understanding of the world that he or she is in. And farther along, that world that the person is in is going to be defined from the individual's perspective. Bronfenbrenner is not interested in whether I think the person understands my world. Bronfenbrenner is not interested in whether I understand the person's view. He's not interested in whether the person is developing a conception that I want the person to have. It's what the person is developing as an understanding of the world that the person is experiencing. Not the world I wish he would experience. Not the world I think is important. Not my world. The person's world. So this is an attempt to define development from the perspective of the person who is going through it as the person's conception of the world the person is experiencing. And that's the view that's valid, the person's view. It's not going to be defined by the professor who says, oh, everybody needs to know this, and your development is dependent on, or I'm going to measure your development by whether you understand the world my way. Not it for Bronfenbrenner. For Bronfenbrenner, the perspective that is important is the individual's perspective, and it's not important whether the perspective matches mine. It's whether or not the perspective is valid in the context that the person is in and useful in that context. So it's a highly individualistic view. And in fact, he will eventually lead us to understand that you have to, in fact, define the ecosystem that the person is in using the person as the reference point. And every individual has a unique ecosystem, and it's uniquely defined using the concepts that are general to all of us, but the specific ecosystem is the person's ecosystem, and it's defined from the person's perspective.
I was going to ask, like, how do you know if someone truly understands the world if you don't have any other person's perspective of what it is?
Great question. How do I understand, how do I really know whether a person's view is valid if I can only look at it from the perspective of the individual? I need another person's perspective. That's probably an unanswered question in Bronfenbrenner. On the other hand, if we're going to be doing scientific study, then we assume that there is a scientist studying. The scientist, though, and this is the key in Bronfenbrenner, the scientist has to try to understand the person's perspective and has to define the ecosystem from the person's perspective. So the scientist can come to a judgment about the person's development, but only after the scientist has tried to define the world from the person's perspective. This is a very useful activity. It's a very useful exercise to say, I can't know whether you are validly understanding and operating in your environment, unless I study your environment. I have to look at your behavior in the context of that behavior, in the context of that environment in which you are behaving. In many ways, Bronfenbrenner has defined a science that is extremely difficult to do. It's extremely difficult to do. But it also has some wonderful caveats or warnings in it for us, because often, very often, when we are trying to influence people's development, we are ignorant, we are ignoring, or as one of my favorite kids says, gnoring. You're gnoring the world the kid actually lives in. You're defining outcomes that you want based on the world that you live in rather than the world the kid lives in. And we are often in the position, and I'm going to use education now just as the example, we're in the process often of defining how well a person is developing based on test scores, which have, you will occasionally observe me editing my language. Yeah, I just did. Which have limited test scores, which have limited validity in the kid's real world. And we have situations where the federal government, which is one of our favorite whipping, is it a person? Anyway, objects. We whip it a lot. The federal government says, okay, we will define whether a school is successful at promoting development on the basis of the test scores that the kids take in math and reading. We know absolutely nothing about the relationship between test scores in mathematics and whether a kid can deal with his environment. Nothing. We know that the SAT, this is one you're familiar with, right? You all took the SAT. Right? What does it predict? It predicts the selectivity of the college that you get into. It does not predict your GPA. Your GPA, which we all know is a measure of success, right? Predicts what after you graduate? What does it predict? The GPA. The selectivity of the graduate school you get into. It has no relationship to your lifetime income. None. The GPA has no relationship to your income the rest of your life. It has no relationship to your success as a parent. It has no relationship to whether or not you will become an alcoholic, a schizophrenic, a drug addict, or anything else that might be interesting to know. It will not predict whether or not you are a good teacher. Don't ask me how to define good teacher. In other words, we are often in the position of attempting to define a person's development independent of the person's world. And Bronfenbrenner has no patience or sympathy with that approach. He says that if you want to know whether or not a person is developing well, figure out what the person's world is and then whether or not the person can deal well with that world, and whether the person understands that world well. Bronfenbrenner, by the way, you're probably by this point deciding that he is way out there somewhere. How many of you have ever heard of Head Start? Bronfenbrenner was one of the creators of Head Start. Yeah. Okay. Among many other nice things that he did in his life. So in addition to being out there theoretically, but out there, so far out, that he calls into question a great deal of our research and much of our social policy, so far out there that he tries to make us think about it in ways that are more extended, differentiated, and valid than the ways we are often thinking about the world that other people live in. I think that's probably a place to ask for questions. The roster went where? Hey, who didn't get it? Okay. Okay. So when it shows up, it needs to go over here. Yeah, keep passing it. Okay. All right, we'll see you on, what's today? Today's Monday. See you Wednesday. Hi. How are you?
Good, I'm good. Did you have a nice break?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. I spoke to you last week. I think my name wasn't on the attendance sheet, so I wrote it in on
good.
The bottom.
Okay. Have you actually enrolled?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't.
It shows up on your schedule.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. When did you actually enroll? Because I printed that out last Wednesday.
It might have been after. I spoke to you about the human
right.
relationships and sexuality
right.
class,
right.
but I think I registered for this one before.
Okay. I may have printed that before it. And
okay.
I probably should have printed a new one today.
Okay. I wrote it on the bottom.
If it shows up there, it'll show up on my next roster.
Okay.
You're okay. Rebecca, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To buy from the bookstore.
Hi.
And then because I
so,
need to
make sure
that
I have this
right.
Can you go to your office now to get the book?
No, because I haven't picked it up from the printer yet.
Okay. When's like the earliest?
It'll depend. They're going to call me when it's bound, and then I'll go pick it up.
Okay.
And then I will email the entire class immediately,
oh, okay.
as soon as I have
okay.
it.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
Hi.
Are you taking on any students or academic advisors?
Well, all my advisors are human development and family studies majors. Who are you? Okay. No, I'm always happy to talk to people, but I can't advise people officially in other colleges.
Out of here. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, if you want to come and talk, just email me.
Yeah. Is the reading only available at Living Learning during office hours, or is it just?
Yeah, it'll only be there during office hours.
So we couldn't possibly get it tomorrow Wednesday then.
Tomorrow, all day.
Okay. So whenever.
Yeah, I will, as soon as I get it back from the printer, I'll email the whole class and let you know how much it is and that it is.
Okay, how much about
it? It'll be about 8. Yeah.
I have a question you probably won't be able to answer.
Sorry.
You know how you're talking about Bronfenbrenners and like looking at their individual perspective and based on their environment? Well, how would you do that without like using your own judgment like of your own environment?
Yeah. You have to. You have to use your own...
Completely take care of.
Right. What Bronfenbrenner says is that what becomes important then is how valid your view of their environment is.
Okay, so you kind of have to...
Yeah, so...
You're making a transaction.
Right,
okay.
Yeah. And that... Have you studied physics at all?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Actually, yeah.
There's a principle called the Heisenberg principle, which is that studying something changes it. So when you're looking at something, and Heisenberg demonstrated it with light waves, that in the process of looking at it,
yeah.
of measuring it, you change it. And I think that's an important principle in thinking about developology from Bronfenbrenner's perspective. Is what he's really saying is that you have to be aware that you may not understand
okay.
the person's perspective. Your challenge is to try.
Okay.
Rather than assume that you know it and
great.
Not think about it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
Can we pick up this book tonight?
Maybe. Unfortunately, I don't know when they will call me and tell me that it's available. I'll run right down and do it. The office will be open until, it's usually closed at 4:30 or 5, but I will be there until 4:45 tonight.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, you can try.
All right, thank you.
Okay. I will email the whole class when I get it back to the office.
Okay.
So you'll know that it's there. I didn't mess up the board much, did I?
No.
Did Brian catch what you have? Not yet. Huh? Well.